everyone. Good morning and welcome. This is Romola D from Romola D Reports, and I'm here today, as you can see, with Paul Anthony Taylor, who's been on the show a few times. Paul Anthony Taylor is the executive director of the Dr. Rath Health Foundation, and I'm really glad to have you here with me this morning, Paul.
Romola, I'm delighted to be back as always. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much, Paul. I should tell everybody that what we're going to be talking about today is a very important subject on which Paul is quite the expert. It has to do with the Codex Alimentarius, and he's going to tell us all about it, including giving us a little bit of his background and about his work at the Dr. Rath Health Foundation. So, Paul, if you could help us out there, that would be great.
Let me see. This year will be 19 years since I joined the Dr. Rath Foundation. It's positively flown by, Romola. It's gone, time
That's
seems to speed up
wonderful.
as one gets older. But I joined in 2003, and I became executive director, I think, in 2010, from memory. Before that, I was in a completely different field of work. I worked as a musician. I was a session player in London. I played keyboards and did computer stuff and played with a lot of hit artists, Paul McCartney and Bryan Ferry and The Verve, Texas, Primal Scream, a lot of big name artists,
Amazing.
Right in the middle of that career, I fell ill with a sort of a chronic fatigue style sort of illness, And it was through the use of nutrition that I eventually got well again. And this had such a profound, effect upon me that it really opened up my eyes to other ways of looking at the world, really, And I remember at the time I wrote a few letters and stuff to politicians, members of parliament and things in Britain, and the British agencies responsible for food and health and supplements. And I gradually realized that in the case of some of the members of parliament, they were just through no fault of their own, they were ignorant, But there were people in the arms of government who clearly knew what was going on and had been lying to the people through government, And I realized gradually there's another issue here, there's another plan, And once I began to realize that actually they were fully aware of some of the things I was talking about in my letters, which is I was very naive, of course, as one starts out at the beginning of all these sort of things. But once I realized that, the government in Britain had been essentially, if you like, lying to me, the obvious question in that case one asks oneself is, well, hey, I wonder what else they may have been lying to me about as well. And of course, once you have that, I mean, you've had this, of course, same experience. Once you've had that sort of experience, it changes your outlook on everything. You approach life with a questioning frame of mind all the time, And this eventually led me to realize that the music industry that I dedicated to my life to up until I was about 40 years old, it was no longer enough for me, And I just as I was having those thoughts, I happened to make contact with some people from Dr. Rath, the early years of the new millennium. And I ended up attending an anti-codex rally Dr. Rath organized in Berlin in, I think it was October 2002,
Oh,
So,
that's interesting.
and then a few months after that, I flew out to the Netherlands and we had some meetings and stuff, and I started doing a bit of part-time work as a sort of consultant and things. And it just started from there, and I left music because I realized there was more important things going on in the world that I wanted to be a part of to try to make some change, you see.
That's absolutely brilliant, and it's kind of interesting and probably synchronistic that we're talking about this subject today, that you started off your career with an anti-codex rally. Very interesting.
Very much so, yeah.
Yeah, so there was an awareness of the Codex Alimentarius project for a very long time then. This is something that's
Very
been
much
going on
so.
for a long time.
Well, the thing that really, for our organization and for many organizations in the field of natural health, the thing that really triggered our interest was these guidelines, a very deceptive word, guidelines they were trying to pass on food supplements, vitamin and mineral food supplements. And you see, the first draft of these guidelines was submitted to Codex, the Codex Nutrition Committee, by the government of Germany in 1992. And it took them really, I think it was 13 years, 13 years until eventually they passed this, which we'll talk about shortly. There you go. They managed to pass that text eventually in 13 years. It was 13 years of struggle. And Dr. Arth was really the first person to bring this issue to global attention, you know, and the only person to have held regular rallies outside the meetings in Germany of this committee, the German Nutrition Committee that developed these guidelines, you see. So Dr. Arth really played a fundamental role in helping bring this issue to the attention of the world, you know, the natural health movement. There's these guidelines. So these guys, the Codex Alimentarius Commission, struggled against opposition, you know, from our side for more than a decade. And so what they ended up with didn't, I think, probably achieve everything they wanted to achieve. The document you had there is sort of a framework document. And I guess things you should know that. Let's go through that and I'll explain to you some of the problems that there are with this document.
That's a great idea. I just wanted to show people on the website, on the internet, the Dr. Arth Foundation website. And this is a health, natural health foundation that's also got an orientation toward peace and social justice. And that's a Dr. Arth. So, and there's a page for you, I guess, right? You can just show us before we move on over here. And you frequently put out articles, so this is something perhaps that people may want to check out from time to time. Come to your page and find your new articles, because you're kind of a media commentator at this point, aren't you?
Indeed, indeed. It's not something that I sort of deliberately chose to be, but you know, I guess Dr. Arth encouraged me to do this. You know, if you have knowledge, you know, the message from him really to me was, you need to learn to share it, you know, and so I had to develop some skills. So I know you're a very accomplished writer yourself, Ramola.
I've had to learn.
You know, I'm a self-taught writer, really, you know, but I've had to learn how to do it.
Oh, brilliant. Well, your articles are great. I always post them and send them around, and you always delve into aspects that aren't quite focused on by other people. So it's, you know, really important to read as well.
Let's take a look then at these guidelines. I mean, you know, the word guidelines is a very sort of deceptive word, and I think probably deliberately, because they also call they call some of their texts standards, you know.
Yes, and I guess one of the big questions would be, I mean, what is the big deal about these guidelines or these standards for vitamin and mineral food supplements that are of concern to you and to everybody in the natural health world?
Well, the clue, and we learned this the more we dug into this at the time, guidelines and standards and codes of practice are essentially all treated the same by the World Trade Organization. I see the World Trade Organization uses Codex texts in its adjudication of trade disputes in the area of food, you see. And the World Trade Organization, when it does that, it doesn't distinguish between whether a text is a guideline or a standard. It has the same status. Okay. So I suspect they chose these guidelines deliberately. You know, they chose to use that word deliberately because they knew already by then the massive opposition to the passing of this text that existed. Because when you realize that these texts, guidelines and standards produced by Codex are used by the World Trade Organization, it's, you know, as I say, adjudication of trade disputes, that essentially makes them part of international law, you see. And so you have to approach this text here that we're looking at with the understanding that essentially, you know, to all intents and purposes, it forms part of international law. The problem starts at the very, very top in the preamble. It says most people who have access to a balanced diet can usually obtain all the nutrients they require from their normal diet. I mean, if you wanted to produce a more loaded sentence, you'd have difficulty, really. Most people, well, not everybody then.
Yeah.
you have access to a balanced diet. Well, you know, last time I looked, there was hundreds of millions of people, perhaps even billions, who don't have access to that.
Absolutely.
So not all the time, usually, sometimes. All the nutrients they require from their normal diet. Well, what is a normal diet? You know, what
very
is a normal
question.
Diet? You know. So, I mean, that sentence straight away sets up on a wrong foot because it's negatively trying to put people off using supplements in the first place.
That's right. That's
right. You know. Nobody is saying that supplements can replace diet, but there are parts of this text, if you look at them, which actually would suggest that some people actually try to do that, which is clearly not true. You know, no, you couldn't. You could not replace a diet with supplements.
Mm-hmm.
If you scroll down, Ramola, it's section three.
Section three.
On composition.
Mm-hmm.
It says vitamin and mineral food supplements should contain vitamins, provitamins, and minerals whose nutritional value for human beings has been proven by scientific data and whose status as vitamin and minerals is recognized by FAO, that's the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, and the World Health Organization. Let's examine that. They should contain vitamins and minerals whose value has been proven by data. Well, proven by whose data? Which data?
Scientific data, sort of very random, mint, anonymous, and neutral.
When a text doesn't define which data and whose data it's talking to, they can use whichever data they want to either disprove, for example, that certain minerals aren't essential, if they want to do that, or even in the case of some other minerals, that they are essential. You may not want to have, you know, I don't know, fluoride in your supplements, perhaps. I would imagine most people would probably balk at that idea. But then there's a key part here, whose status is recognized by FAO and WHO. We'll come back to that. Let's scroll down to the next section, section 3.2. That status thing we'll come back to, Ramola, in a few moments.
Okay.
Section 3.2 talks about maximum amounts of vitamins and minerals in supplements. The daily portion shall be set. So they're going to have maximum amounts. They want to limit the maximum dose you can take. They haven't done yet.
Nice.
What they're going to do, which you see, this text was taken from the European Union's legislation.
Okay.
The European Union has 27 countries, and it argues as a block, as a lobby block.
Mm-hmm.
And it managed with this to essentially make this text reflect pretty much European Union law. That's what it did. The biggest, most important, most powerful player at Codex now is the European Union. And what it's trying to do is to shape international food law to reflect European food law, which is very restrictive.
That's really interesting. And if you look at both of these statements over here, these two subsections, one talks about the minimum level and one talks about the maximum level. So you're suggesting that they are trying to really delimit the amount of vitamin or mineral that's being recommended.
Yeah.
And would this have repercussions for what appears in the market, you know, in those vitamin bottles?
Absolutely, absolutely. If you want to trade supplements, that is the implication.
Okay.
And you see, I mean, yeah, I wasn't going to mention that, but the minimum level, so they're essentially stating that the minimum level of any vitamin or mineral in a supplement should be 15%. But you see, if you want the most effective scientific, you know, supplements, mm-hmm. are designed, what you would say, synergistically, where the amount of each nutrient is very carefully calibrated mm-hmm. for the best synergistic interaction. And you might want to have of a certain nutrient, a combination, less than 15%. You know, there's no scientific basis for that restriction to be set there.
Oh, wow. That's really interesting. Thank you for explaining that, because you're suggesting, for instance, in any kind of formulation of a multivitamin or a multi-mineral supplement, you might want less of something and more of something else.
Yeah, because you might want a very small amount to synergistically trigger through a higher amount of something else, some specific biological reaction, you see.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. And there's no basis in science for the choice of that minimum 15%. There absolutely isn't. It's arbitrary. Why not 20%? Wow. Why not 10%? Why not 25%? There's no reason. There is no reason. But the biggest danger by far in that section is the idea that they plan, because this is a framework document, really. That's all they were able to pass in the end.
Mm-hmm.
But that aim is there, the set maximum amount, maximum dosage, you know. But when you look at what they want to do, they want to establish these levels by what they call scientific risk assessments.
Wow.
Based on generally accepted scientific data. Now, you know,
I see exactly what you mean. Who exactly is to
order? No, it's their data. It's the WHO, FAO data, you know.
Wow.
But not just that. When they do this, they also, if you look at B there, they're going to take into account the daily intake of vitamins and minerals from other sources, other dietary sources.
Oh, my.
So once they've established some low sort of maximum dose they'll allow you to take, they're going to say, oh, yes, but of course, they're already getting X amount from their diet, so we'll subtract that from the maximum dose, and then we'll arrive at what they're allowed to take.
Oh, my God. And once again, this sort of sounds, because we've got world organizations here. We've got the World Health Organization, the Food and Agriculture Organization. These world organizations, very global, you know, involving the consent of every government on the globe, or the flat earth, whatever it is.
Bill Gates as well. Let's not forget Bill Gates.
And let's not forget Bill Gates, who's behind the WHO and so much else. You know, you have to see this as sort of, again, a globalist move on humanity then, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, that's the whole thing. If you control food, you control the people, you know. But look at the last little bit. Ramola, underneath B there.
Yeah.
When maximum levels are set, due account may be taken of the reference intake values of vitamins and minerals population. This should not lead to the setting of maximum levels that are solely based on recommended intakes. That solely, we fought bitterly to avoid that word in there, because that infers the setting of maximum levels will partly be based on recommended daily amounts, which is the minimal amounts necessary to sustain life, you know.
Oh, I see. How very interesting.
Solely is such a loaded word, because
all of this,
being the level will be partly based, not on science, but on the recommended daily amounts, the minimum daily amounts, you see.
So, in a sense, what they're using these recommended daily allowance as a kind of a gate that's closed already. And you
absolutely. Now, as I said, they haven't set maximum levels yet. They're waiting for the European Union to set theirs, because they know that the European Union, with its 27 countries and lobbying as a bloc, can more or less do pretty much anything it chooses now, you know.
Yeah, wow, this is, as you say, all of this is so dangerous. And you'd wanted to come back to, this is all part of the selection of the vitamins and minerals, right?
What we should do now, Ramona, we should move on. There's another document I gave you, which is some comments. That's what we're going to look at next.
Okay. Was it the, I don't think it was this. Let me actually stop sharing screen and come back, because I had it on another browser.
Well, let me tell a story while you're looking for that there. So I sat in attending these meetings where this was all playing out. So I sat on the delegation of a US organization, the National Health Federation, there you go, who have observer status at Codex meetings. So they were able to attend and watch and speak out at these meetings. And so the whole process eventually arrived down at the meeting of the Codex Alimentarius Commission. If you imagine, there's the commission, which is the head organization of the, you know, the sort of the head body of the group of organizations, of committees. But underneath that, there's the 20-odd committees who each specialize in the various aspects of the food trade, you know, pesticides, food additives and things, nutrition. So the whole process got down to this final meeting in Rome in July 2005. And so we drafted some comments to submit, as all attending organizations are allowed and able to. We drafted comments to be distributed at the meeting. Mm-hmm. And really, you know, based on what we found, and I'll briefly describe it in a moment, these guidelines should never have been passed. They were breaking their own rules.
Oh.
First of all, there's three reasons for this. First of all, the guidelines do not state their purpose. There's a thing called the Codex Procedural Manual, and they produce one of these every year, a new draft of this. This is the rule book,
okay.
The Codex rule book. And certainly at that time, the manual stated that all standards and related texts should have a preface containing a brief description of the scope and purpose of the text. Well, these guidelines we're looking at a moment ago, they do not state their purpose. They did not state the purpose. So there was one reason there why the text, the guidelines should not have been adopted. The second
That's really interesting.
Yeah, so... it's shocking. It really is shocking when they're prepared to break their own rules. The second one is that the guidelines do not actually define what vitamins and minerals they cover.
Oh,
they talk about nutrients whose status is recognized by FAO and WHO. But when we looked into it, we realized actually there was no definitive book or text or document stating which nutrients FAO or WHO recognized. So the guidelines didn't define what they covered, even though they referred to the idea that FAO or WHO could do that. So there's
That's two reasons. So very broad based, no list of vitamins and minerals included with these guidelines. But a presumption that their status is recognized by FAO and WHO. So is one supposed to go dig into the FAO and WHO documents to find out what those are?
Well, we did that. I spent quite a bit of time doing that at the time.
Okay.
Prior to this meeting. And then the third one was that the guidelines actually exempt countries that choose to regulate vitamins and minerals as drugs. That's actually stated in the text. So, you know, if you want to regulate them as drugs and regulate them even more harshly.
Ah, so this is the crux of it.
That's what they want. These guidelines don't apply to you guys. Carry on, you know, off you go.
Yeah, so this is amazing. I think this is so important. And, you know, this kind of points to what they're really trying to do, isn't it? This is sort of the subtext of what they're trying to do. They want countries to regulate vitamins and minerals as drugs.
And I mean, the most absurd part of this came. So if you imagine, Ramona, we're sitting in this meeting in the FAO headquarters in Rome in July 2005. Mm-hmm. And it comes to the discussion of this topic, the vitamin mineral supplement guidelines. And we suddenly realized that the FAO staff hadn't actually distributed this document.
Oh.
None of the delegates from the government had seen it.
How odd.
And we pointed out, you know, on the microphone, and they hurriedly tried to throw out a few copies. But basically, they passed this guideline with the vast majority of delegates never having seen, to my knowledge, this document. Not just that, Ramona, it gets even worse, because if you try and search for this document on the internet, I did this week before we arranged the talk, you won't find it. To the best of my knowledge, this document is actually not posted anywhere on the web.
This you're talking about your document.
I'm talking about what you're looking at here. These comments.
So this is the Natural Health Foundation comments, right?
The National Health Federation.
National Health Federation. Yeah. Oh, that's right. And that's Scott Tipps's
association,
right? Yeah.
And by rights, based upon these three arguments, those guidelines we were looking at a few minutes ago should never have been passed because they're inconsistent with what this says, their own rules, you see. But it gets worse. So as I say, you know, you will search in vain, so far as I can see, to find these anywhere on the internet. I mean, maybe
this
we should...
This is really interesting. So they kind of have outlawed the posting of any kind of commentary questioning or challenging their guidelines.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying? And the other thing is this list of vitamins and minerals that's completely missing from their guidelines. They don't really point to where you can find it, or were you able to find such a list when you looked
No. We drafted at the time these comments because I, after an exhaustive search, I determined that there was no definitive text where FAO and WHO actually stated what vitamins and minerals they recognized as such.
Wow, that's really interesting. So what do you think, what kind of loophole does that offer them, do you think, in terms of further strictures and regulations of vitamins and minerals?
I mean, it may be, Romola, that since 2005, perhaps WHO, FAO do now have a definitive list, but that I haven't checked. But you see, that would still mean the list was created after the guidelines existed.
Oh, very good point.
Whichever way you look at it, it's still wrong, you know. You know, the delegates from governments agree to this text not knowing which vitamins and minerals were being covered by it.
Yeah, so what do you think their intention was in putting out such a vague statement?
I mean, their intention was to get these guidelines through to international law status come hell or high weather, you know.
Ah, okay. And do it before anything could be defined even.
Yeah, I mean, in the case of the purpose, to be honest, I'm not sure whether that was accidental or deliberate, missing that out.
Okay.
When we brought it up at the committee stage in Germany, I saw the then chairman of that committee, a man by the name of Rolf Grossklaus, I think his name was. I saw him shake his head and sort of do this at the front of the room, you know. So it may well be that it was simply an omission. However, if we move on to the UN press release that I also sent you earlier this week.
Yes, let me pull out one more time and find that screen. I did notice that I think I looked up the FAO. I should actually pull up the FAO and the WHO, the Codex Alimentarius, one more time and just show that online so people can find it. I guess it's both at the FAO and the WHO, but this is the, oh, I'm not online. Okay, I'm not.
Yeah, what happened was the United Nations, a couple of days after the meeting in Rome had finished, they put out this news release.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, the news release told you why they created these guidelines, you know. I'm holding everyone in suspense here. Wait till you get it up, I guess.
Sorry, it's right here. I was trying to move it from one spot to another.
I'll tell you anyway. So the news release said that the title was UN Commission, that's Codex, adopts safety guidelines for vitamin and mineral food supplements. But the first sentence is the killer. Labeling to stop consumers overdosing on vitamin and mineral food supplements.
Oh my gosh.
Right. It's passed today. So, I mean, that's what it was about. But I mean, having said that, they know the same as we know that it's very, very, very difficult to overdose on any vitamin. You've got to be reckless and extremely careless to do so.
Mm-hmm.
They know this, but their press release was clearly designed, you know, to put out the message that we're controlling these things because they're dangerous.
Well, you know, this is the trick that all governments use at all times, isn't it? They call on safety. It's public safety and public health that we're calling on to sneak in some highly pernicious and harmful requirement or regulation. And that seems to be what's going on over here. So this is sort of, it almost sounds like cover speak. This is the cover that they're using. To present their extreme interest, excruciating interest in vitamin and mineral food supplements and in regulating them.
Yes. And of course, the reason why they're doing this is because, you know, the health properties of nutrients obviously are a threat to drugs, to multi-billion dollar drugs, of course.
And there we go. And that is the ultimate danger that they see, right? Because, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, isn't it, well, you mentioned a minute ago, Bill Gates is behind the WHO. And so you've got multinational corporations behind these organizations, right? And your reading is that they're connected to the entire drug industry, the whole pharmaceutical industry.
Well, if you look, you know, at the at any Codex meeting to do with nutrition or this area, you invariably find that the attendees include, you know, representatives of the drug industry, the chemical industry, because of course they produce the additives and pesticides, of course, you know.
Biotech.
Yeah, the drug industry does send people. I mean, you know, a while ago I compiled a list of companies that had attended, you know, over the years the Codex Nutrition Committee, the German committee, you know, the draft of the guidelines. And all the big drug firms are there, you know, they've all been involved with this at some point or another. They see these things as a threat from all, you see.
That explains a great deal, because I think not most people would know that there are those drug industry connections and chemical industry connections to the Food and Agriculture Organization and the World Health Organization. And this interest in regulating vitamin and mineral food supplements is very connected to protecting their drug profits. It's just shocking. I mean, that's shocking enough, but you had another point to make about natural ingredients being encroached on, right?
I was going to say that, you see, natural, you know, ingredients, nutrients, more effective than drugs, they're safer than drugs, and they're more affordable than drugs, you know. And most important of all, you can't patent them. You can't patent vitamin C. You can't say you invented vitamin C. That's created by nature. It exists in nature. So this is why drug firms don't have any interest in vitamins, because they can't patent them. They can't control them.
That's really interesting. So is this the case with all vitamins then? Because all vitamins come from natural herbs and things, right?
You cannot patent a naturally occurring vitamin.
Okay. Isolated and you as a specific separate biomolecule like vitamin C, you can't.
Vitamins come in natural and synthetic forms, and of course the most effective forms are the natural forms.
Okay, so they are making some vitamins in synthetic forms.
If you go to your local supermarket, see the lines of vitamin bottles on the shelves there, they're invariably low doses of synthetic nutrients, synthetic vitamins.
That's true. You have to kind of look for the ones that say organic or natural on them.
The doctors and therapists who treat patients, prevent and, you know, treat diseases with nutrients, they'll all tell you that naturally occurring forms of nutrients are the best.
Yes.
You know, which stands to reason. That's how nature designed it.
We're part of nature, and those things are sort of more assimilable or digestible by the human body.
Of course. Mm-hmm. You know, our species developed over a very, very long period of time through relying on these nutrients in our foods to sustain our bodies and, you know, maintain our health.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. The drugs produced by drug companies don't exist in nature. And if, you know, people might say, well, yes, but what about foxglove, you know, the used as a heart medication? Well, in fact, what drug companies do when they look at a naturally occurring molecule, rather than use the whole herb, they'll isolate what they consider to be the active ingredient, create a synthetic version of that, and market that as a drug. But the drugs used as, let's say, chemotherapy, you know, they have no counterpart in nature. They don't exist in the food supply. No, and this goes for the vast majority of drugs that are being used right now.
They isolate the most toxic, the most potent aspect of whatever they're looking for, whether it's belladonna or whatever, and they create very toxic substances, which then they have to figure out the right dosage for, which is the whole thing about vaccine clinical trials as well, right? They're trying to figure out the right dosage.
Yeah, I mean, look, and doctors, and herbalists who use herbs for medicine will tell you that it's the whole herb that has the effect.
That's right.
It's the chorus of molecules in the herb that has a collective synergistic effect. If you isolate what you consider to be the molecule that has the greatest effect, and then synthesize a synthetic version of that, it ain't the same. It ain't the
Absolutely.
same, you know. But yeah, and of course, that's the reason drugs have side effects, of course, because the molecules that they consist of don't exist in nature. The body does not have any easy means of, using them. Our species did not develop on drugs. We developed on nutrients. We grew up on nutrients.
That's really powerfully explained. Thank you for describing that whole process, because that also sort of establishes how we as humans have a natural visceral connection to nature
Yes.
and to what can be found in nature.
Absolutely. And I think this is, if there's one thing that for me, being a regular viewer of your show, Ramola, that connects a lot of it together, is the fact that I feel that, humanity is gradually moving towards this understanding that natural ways of living, eating and behaving for that matter, the right direction to follow, and so much of what's happening in the world right now, the challenges in the world right now, have arisen because humankind hasn't been doing that. We've been forced into, if you like, the opposite way of looking at things.
We've been really moved away from our source and our center, and it's
Very
taken
much
sort of this whole global movement to try to
so.
bring us back.
I mean, if you ask me to sum up, what Codex is, it's really it's a primary political battlefield where the war is being waged over who controls the global food and nutrient supply. That's what it does. I mean, it mandates, it specifically allows pesticides to be used in foods, artificial additives to be used in foods, GM ingredients to be used in foods, foods to be irradiated, it specifically allows that as well. And all of these things are all things that if the average person understood this, that these things in their foods are mandated in what essentially amounts to international law, I'd imagine they'd be quite shocked.
Do you feel looking at the whole panorama of what they are permitting, and especially since you've been looking at this across time, do you feel that they've been actually moving toward an increased acceptance of these kinds of synthetic ingredients, bioengineered ingredients, genetically modified ingredients, and away from natural
Yeah.
ingredients?
Yes, absolutely, Ramola. And for one simple reason, we said before that they prefer drugs to vitamins. You can patent drugs. You can patent pesticides. You can patent artificial food additives. You can certainly patent, of course, GM seeds. So they always prefer the unnatural, the synthetic that doesn't exist in nature, because they can patent it, they can control it, and control markets with it. Organic food is a threat to them because it doesn't use pesticides or these artificial additives. It doesn't use GM materials. And even more important, of course, organic food has been shown to be higher in essential nutrients as well. And that's a threat. These guys, the biggest investors see this. There's no doubt. So they're all of their actions point towards it. They see organic food as a threat, no doubt. In fact, Codex has actually been watering down the rules at the global level for organic foods. They permit several substances now through the Codex guidelines for organic foods. They permit several substances that really don't belong in there at all. You know, they'd rather see organic food production move towards the same approach that big agriculture uses. So they allow, you know, I mean, the best example is probably ethylene. Now, fruits produce ethylene as a normal part of their ripening process. Well, Codex now allows ethylene to be used to artificially induce kiwi fruit and bananas to ripen, for example. And this is not done for any other reason, except that if you grow food on the other side of the planet and you want to ship it across to, you know, another continent, you want to pluck it before it's ripe, deep freeze it, unfreeze it, or probably, you know, at the other end, and artificially treat it with ethylene. You know, and it's a natural process. You know, if you're packing food in very, very cold, you know, tanks, boxes, however they pack them, pre-ripen, then artificially induce them to ripe by applying ethylene. That shouldn't be allowed to be called organic food, but that's what's happening now.
Oh, and they call it organic.
Yep, they're calling it organic, yeah. I mean, I made a list before we came on this today. And also, they use ethylene for the degreening of citrus fruits, as a flowering agent for pineapples, and as a sprouting inhibitor for potatoes and onions. They also allow sulfur dioxide to be included in organic foods, and a substance called carrageenan, which can cause ulcers in the intestines and tumors in the gut. So they're gradually moving to water down the organic rules, if you like, for international trade, because the big agriculture companies realize they can charge higher prices for food labeled organic, but they don't want to play by the same rules as the small farmers, of course, who they want to get out of business in the first place. So they push, the chemical companies push for these, you know, approaches to be allowed in the big corporations who produce the seeds and things. They're all very much behind this because they see profit, right? But the food, really, much of the food, you know, that's being produced now organically, got to be very, very careful. Particularly, as I say, the citrus fruits and bananas and things, the pineapples, because depending how far they've come, you know, to reach your plate, your kitchen, your fridge, they may well have been treated in this way, you know. So it's a very worrying situation, really, Ramola, I think. And I think a lot of people, if they knew what's going on, would be very, very shocked.
It is, and it's particularly curious that you've got a Codex Alimentarius Commission that's focused on regulating vitamins and minerals, whereas another arm of the Food and Agriculture Organization permits all of this. So, I mean, this isn't healthy, right? I mean, how does health come into this whole scenario? Aren't they supposed to be focused on human health? Especially
the World Health Organization? Yeah, you see, if you, again, to go back to this rule book, the procedural manual, they call it. They claim to be protecting consumers and to be ensuring what I think they describe as fair practices in the food trade. But of course, the food trade, meaning business and consumers, people, we have different interests. We do not have, you cannot possibly represent them both. You can't, you know. And having attended, I think, about 7 international meetings of different committees of Codex at the, you know, international level, I can tell you straight that the interests they represent are the industrial interests, the corporate interests. Consumers come a very, very poor second in this particular equation, I'm afraid.
That's really interesting. So you've actually been present at those meetings, and you've actually heard those representatives of these, I guess, big multinationals speaking, right? Because they aren't. Are they the people who are actually occupying positions of power on these commissions?
Some no, but I'd say positions of influence. Some of these corporate guys sit on the national delegations, and you see them whispering to the head of the national delegation. You know. Others will sit on industry federations and associations, you know, and speak that way, you know. They're there, you know, and they have influence. I mean, I attended one meeting on one occasion, like what you'd call a pre-Codex meeting, at the in London, the UK Food Standards Agency had its pre-Codex meeting one year, and I managed to attend that. And that was just full of corporate guys, you know, that was just all over the room. And it became, at that point, you know, brutally apparent to me that that meeting was held for the UK food standards people to find out from industry what they wanted, you know. And that would formulate the UK position. At that time, the UK was part of the European Union, so we were one of, I think it was 28 countries at that time, who then formulated a European position, of course. And of course, let's go back to that, the European Union, of course. So the countries that are part of the European Union are not allowed to argue against anything that's already law in their own countries.
That's really interesting.
So they go to these meetings, allowed to support what the European Commission, the executive body in Europe, says at the meetings, but they can't argue against it because these things are already law in their own countries.
Wow, so it's that kind of extreme hold that's being brought now across the world with these guidelines. So what is the status currently of these guidelines?
Well, the vitamin and mineral guidelines, well, there's been no further development essentially since 2005 at Codex level. However, the European Union is making noises now about setting its own maximum level for vitamins and
The
minerals.
European Union.
It knows from when it passed its own legislation 2002, I think it was. That it will have a hell of a fight if and when it tries to do that. It had a hell of a fight last time. But if it was able to do this, it would then, the next step would be to go straight to Codex and try and have those then mirrored, you know, at the international level to be added
And
to that.
how, I'm sorry, do you hear an audio interference?
Not at my end. Everything sounds good to me.
Everything sounds good to you. Well, I'm definitely being interfered with every time I speak. I'm hearing all sorts of strange echoes.
You sound good to me, Romola. You sound good to me.
Thank you. Thank you, Paul. I'm glad I'm getting across over there, if not right here. But the question I was going to ask was, how does this translate to the consumer? You know, if this happens, if they're able to push through this horrific plan, which I certainly hope they have massive resistance for and can't push through, how might it affect the consumer? I mean, might we see lesser numbers of vitamins and minerals on the shelves that we can just go and buy at the
Well, this
supermarket?
is always the always has been the question as to how this impacts in the real world, you know. And essentially, at least theoretically, it shouldn't affect supplement products that are sold, let's say, in the United States within your own borders, you know, within the borders of the US state. What it does do, of course, it means that it's implying that this standard applies for international trade at the international level. Now, the issue there is, of course, that would companies be prepared if they want to ship products into Europe that was highly restrictive on nutrient levels? Would American companies be prepared to produce two sets of products? My guess is not. You know, companies want to exist to make money first and foremost, but they're not charities, you know. And so the danger is that if maximum levels were set at Codex, it would act as an inducement for countries to mirror what would then be the same levels at international level in Codex and in the European Union. You know, if you want to sell into Europe, you've got to comply with these regulations. And American companies, which is probably the most liberal market in the world, I guess, for food supplements, they'd essentially find themselves shut out of Europe, you know. There's not that many countries, if you look at it, Romola, that have a liberal approach to the regulation of supplements. There's the United States, UK, Ireland, Netherlands, Sweden, maybe New Zealand. It's a small handful. Most countries, if you look, I mean, so you saw before the comments that we took to that meeting.
Right.
I've got a huge shelf on my wall over there with comments I brought back from other countries at these various meetings.
Oh, really?
When those guidelines were being passed, you regularly saw countries like Brazil was one I remember off the top of my head, arguing that maximum level should not exceed the RDA, you know. So your 60 milligrams a day of vitamin C should be the maximum you're allowed to take in a supplement. And Brazil, I'm not singling out Brazil, you know, Brazil weren't alone in that. There were plenty of countries supporting that position.
No, a lot of people listening to this might be thinking, well, whose business is it of theirs anyway? You know, the amount of vitamin C I take in a day, or of E or D or anything else.
I mean, look, you know, without widening the discussion too far, you know, I've made no secret of the fact that I'm not vaccinated against COVID, you know. I subscribe to the, I'm 60 years old now, Romola. It might be old fashioned, but I consider it my body, my choice.
Absolutely.
You know.
Nor am I. And it's my body, my choice all the way. And I think a ton of people listening to us feel exactly the same.
I'm sure. And you see, but to me, the same applies to nutrition. The nutrition I put in my mouth, be it organic food or whatever, it's my body, my choice. You know? The government,
bodily autonomy, individual sovereignty.
My body, you know, my choice. I decide for myself. Thank you very much. You know, and so yeah, it comes down to that for me, Romola, really.
It does, and this is why I was asking what you saw across the arc of time over here, Paul, because it seems to me, if indeed that this is the case, if indeed multinational corporations are striving hard to take control of this through international trade. And through globalist organizations such as this, I mean, doesn't that kind of project a kind of total takeover of human choice in everything related to food, drugs, pharma, anything we choose to ingest?
Well, indeed. I mean, you know, over the last couple of years since the start of this, what they call pandemic, let's say, that is what we've seen. I think, you know, if there's been a benefit to this, it's that more and more people, I feel, are waking up and realizing this now. And the control of food and nutrition is just another part of that. It's another part of that same system of control that's trying to exert its influence over us in so many different ways right now.
Would you say this is part of the whole Agenda 21 sustainable development spectrum that they've got going?
I wouldn't want to ascribe it to any particular agenda, except in the very loose sense that, you know, those of us, Dr. Arth particularly, you know, and myself, who've been working in this field for a couple of decades now, know that this agenda, you know, with a small a, has been developing for a long time. You know, the things we're witnessing around us, I think perhaps we've talked before, just without going too far away from Codex, the European Union was talking about vaccine passports 20 months before the pandemic started, you know.
That's
so,
right.
But back to Codex, these guys have a long-term plan. It's a long-term, as you describe it, the Codex Alimentarius project you describe our talk tonight. That's what it is. It's a long-term plan. These guys are very, very prepared and able and willing and practiced in the art of moving slowly. Boiling the frog slowly, as the saying goes. This didn't just start yesterday or 2 years ago or even, you know, a decade ago. It's all part of the gradual corporate creep, the connections between, you know, the usual people, the corporates, you know, the governments, the media, and now, of course, joined by big tech, who all feed off each other and share a very similar mindset, and it seems now clear to all of us, I think, very similar goals.
Absolutely. A terrific term that you used right there, corporate creep. I think that's precisely what it is. And you know, the whole boiling the frog concept, I think many of us have woken up to it now. And even though we can't quite see one particular agenda, you know, Agenda 21 still needs to be dissected, but it seems like it's something that's placed on top of very long-term, other long-lasting agendas that have existed across decades and that have now brought us to this point. I mean, everything associated with the United Nations, for that matter, appears to have been set in stone from way back. And
yeah, I mean, you know, the United Nations certainly seems to be some sort of, you know, rudimentary framework form of global governance. That's the way it seems to function now. You know, it's got its health organization, its food organization, its trade organization, and all the rest. So, and of course, you know, again, just take the World Health Organization. We know how it receives a lot of funding from Gates, but from pharma companies too, and the banks and stuff. They're all listed there among the funders. Last time I checked, about half the funding came from governments. The other half came from corporates and Gates and people like that, you know.
Big foundations, yeah, absolutely.
And there's no way, of course, that that funding from the corporate sector and Gates doesn't come at a price. These companies don't give that money for no reason and sit back and say, there you go, do whatever you want with it. They give that for a reason, because they have an agenda, you know, and it's to the real detriment of journalists. But that hasn't been properly covered. There's an assumption that it's the World Health Organization. Oh, it must be right. Rubbish, you know. They take so much money from the corporate sector and Gates that they've been bought. Their influence, their position, their policies have been bought. And I think the more people who understand this, really, Ramona, the better, right?
Absolutely. And I think this conversation you've had today, Paul, I think that you've really helped us see quite a bit that this agenda is not about health, but it's being couched in the language of health, in the language of public safety. And it's an agenda of control, ultimately, and it seems to fit right into that larger agenda of control that we're seeing being played out with this quote-unquote pandemic and the vaccines. The vaccines seem to be all what it's all about. And of course, what's inside the vaccines and their future plans for complete domination of the human body and the human brain, as you know.
I that's a good place to sort of finish, I think, because, you know, I would very much encourage people to look into this topic, and as you said, to see it as a part of the bigger picture. You know, this is not a separate issue. When you're talking about food and nutrition and health, this is very much an issue that's right now. You know, if you want to protect yourself against pandemics, viruses, any disease, food and nutrition are fundamentally important.
Absolutely. And I think large part of us understand their close connection to actual individual health as opposed to these vast chimeras of quote-unquote public health. Indeed. Paul, thank you so much for being here today. And, you know, I guess I wanted to leave with one last question, and that is, what can the average person do? I mean, somebody who's listened to us, who can hear everything you're saying, who's very concerned about this whole project, the Codex Alimentarius, is there anything anyone can do? I mean, just being a normal person, can you do something? Can you write letters? What can you do?
Well, I mean, the first thing I would say is information is power, forewarned is forearmed. Get yourself educated. So join our Dr. Art Health Foundation newsletter list, subscribe to our newsletter, get yourself informed and educated, then and tell others, you see. It's no good if we all, you know, watch the wonderful presentations that you do and then we don't share it with other people and tell other people. The only way out of this mess, really, that we're now facing in the world is to, as I say, it's two-part. Educate ourselves and tell others. Educate yourself in being very, very careful about what information you take on. Be very, very careful on the sources. I can guarantee you our foundation has been following this for a long time, this topic of the Codex Alimentarius Commission. So subscribe to our newsletter. We have a lot of material on our website already, actually, that can be used and educational tools. But yeah, educate and share. Educate and share.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Paul. I will post all of the links to your website below this video. That's absolutely great advice to leave for this morning. Thanks so much, everybody, for watching. Thank you again, Paul. And hopefully we'll have you back very soon again to provide further commentary on something else that's going on.
It's always a pleasure, Paul. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Bye for now.